Concession number 10086, reel number 2.
Captain Ashcroft, reel 2.
And a petty officer came down on the trawler to check troops ashore. The WVS was standing by on the shore, ready to welcome them. And we started unloading the troops from off the deck. When the last ones had gone off the deck, the petty officer started to depart and light on us. And I said, hang on a minute, you haven't got them yet. And Roger in the wheelhouse sung out and come up from down below, and they started trooping up from down below. Eventually, we counted 129 troops aboard. And when they were all gone, the petty officer had made it 128. So Lighthouse said, well, there must be another one somewhere. And he went down below. And there, sitting on the loo, fast asleep, was one nearly unconscious, Tommy. He woke up and said, come on, lad, time to go home. Up staggered the last one, went up on deck, and the petty officer said, my God, mate, where did you put them all? Light I replied, you might well ask. And that, unfortunately, was the end of Sundowners Dunkirk, because they wouldn't allow any small craft to go over after that.
We haven't said anything about the Sundowner in detail. Can you give a detailed description of her?
Very. But she'd always stick in my mind. She was a 56-foot naval pinnace from the 1914-18 war. And after the 1914-18 war, Commander Lighthouse, who had served as captain of a destroyer, and one of a few reserve officers in command of a destroyer to ever sink a German submarine, went back to a White Star Line, but because his name was synonymous with a Titanic, he was never given a command of his own. He realised that he was being put from the first class passenger ships to lower class passenger ships to cargo ships. And he got no future with a White Star Line. He carried a can back for it, and that was the end of him there. So he went ashore, started up a chicken farm, which oddly enough, a seaman that retires in those days, chicken farm or an egg farm was the ideal thing for him. But he wanted to get back on the water. He was looking around for a suitable boat. He saw this ex-naval pinnace. Being ex-navy man, he knew what fine boats they were. He bought the pinnace. His wife was an invalid, so he had the pinnace converted to a yacht, and specially converted so that his wife would be able to enjoy pleasures of a boat as much as he would himself. Now Conyers Boatyard converted it to his plans. He cruised extensively between the wars with his family aboard and his wife Sylvia. Shortly before the outbreak of war, when to a war ministry, war was imminent, he was approached as a known yachtsman and master mariner who knew German Scandinavian coast well, to go over to a German coast and to take soundings and details of a shoreline, to note places where, in the event of war, if Britain had to make a landing on a German coast, of where to be possible to do so. And that he only finished shortly before returning to Cuba's Yacht Basin at the outbreak of war.
Can you describe the Sundowner in terms of length and engine power and so on?
Yes, she had 6 foot added to her stern while she was being converted to a yacht, which made her 62 foot overall. Originally she was fitted with a petrol paraffin motor, was found not to be powerful enough. So she was fitted with a Gallifer diesel engine. Can't recall the horsepower of it offhand. I should say about 75 horsepower, which gave her a service speed of 10 knots. She was designed by Commander Lightoller with a more or less central wheelhouse of considerable dimensions, partly sunk into a deck, with the engine directly underneath the wheelhouse, after end of a wheelhouse floor. Far of the wheelhouse below, he had a very extensive saloon. Far of that, she had a cabin on either side. And then right up far in the forecastle. After a wheelhouse below came the engine room, the bathroom, a single cabin on one side, on the port side, and then a double large berth aft with a galley. And you had an open cockpit right up the stern of it, where Sylvia used to sit and do the vegetables and get the food ready.
And I understand that you took no armaments of any kind across with you to Dunkirk?
No, none whatsoever.
Did you ever see Commander Lightoller again after Dunkirk?
Yes, I saw him on one occasion during the war when I was on leave and came to Brighton to stay on leave. And he had arrived then in charge of a motor fishing vessel that he was delivering to Lowestoft for the Navy. Then again I met him after the war when I went with a yacht up the Thames to Richmond, where he had established a yacht yard known as Richmond Slipways at Isawa.
What kind of a man was he as a character?
Oh, when you say what kind of a man was he as a character, he had a character all of his own, and the best way to define him in one word was a man. He had an extraordinary personality. He was the type of man who would be completely competent with, but what decision he made, you would take for granted was the correct one, whether you agreed or disagreed. He had that type of personality. And he was a man that I would have followed anywhere. I tried to model my life on. He taught me an awful lot. I knew him before, of course. And the lesson he taught me that day when we were getting ready with the Sundowner to cover every eventuality And when I commented to him on what a lovely trip it was so far, nearly halfway out from Ramsgate to Dunkirk, he said something to me that I've never forgotten in my life. He said, "You've got nothing to worry about." And I said, "No, nothing at all." Well, he said, "Now is the time you should be worrying. When things are going all right, you should be standing there saying to yourself, now, what can go wrong? And you should be working out what you're going to do if it does go wrong. And when anything goes wrong, you know immediately what to do. You've worked it out. You've thought of all the possibilities that you could do. And you could try. And you've made up your mind which is the best one. And always, especially when you're at sea, bear that in mind and just think of any possibility that can go wrong and how you're going to deal with it."
How had you come across him in the first place?
When he kept his yacht in Cubitt's Yacht Basin, and we had a boat in Cubitt's Yacht Basin, and of course you all knew one another, and I'd been aboard a Sundowner with him, and he'd been teaching me the finer parts of navigation. After Night Otter died, the Sundowner was put up for sale, and she passed through several hands up until 1986, when she was off Ramsgate in heavy weather, was taking water. They couldn't get her bilge pump working. And they sent up a distress call. She was escorted into Ramsgate Harbour by the Ramsgate lifeboat, where she was left to sink on the hard standing in the harbour. But she was taken over, rather should I say purchased, by the East Kent Maritime Museum, who refloated her, had her lifted up onto the wall outside of the museum headquarters, where in June 1987 she was presented on behalf of the East Kent Maritime Museum with the colours for Dunkirk, and where the museum are hoping to restore her to her former glory and use her for training local youths in navigation and seamanship. So I'm looking forward to going down within the next couple of years anyway and seeing her put back in the water and put to a use that I'm sure Commander Lightoller would have wished her to be used for after his death.
Were you present on that day in June 1987?
Yes. And also, I'm looking forward very eagerly and hoping that when the 50th anniversary of Dunkirk comes up, that I shall be able to go aboard of a Sundowner and travel to Dunkirk with her.
Now, I think that after having taken part in the Dunkirk evacuation, you felt that you wanted, later in 1944, to be involved with the return of British forces to France.
Well, to me it was a natural thing. Having brought the men out from France, I wished to take them back again. Now, I was in general service in the Navy at the time, Royal Navy, and I applied for a transfer to combined operations, which was granted, and I went as first lieutenant onto a tank landing craft. Fortunately, prior to the invasion of Normandy, I was given command of tank landing craft 517. So I was able to fulfil my ambition when we had that carried the tanks that were to knock out the pool box defences on the west side of Cassell's Harbour. And furthermore, I took great delight in hearing on the wireless at 8 o'clock in the morning that reports of airborne troops landing in Normandy had been announced. So far, no seaborne landings have been made. So it was a case of full speed for Beach, and I had the great pleasure of putting ashore the first tanks of the 3rd Canadian Armoured Division to knock out the pillboxes guarding the beach.
Can you tell me what the crossing was like to Normandy?
From our point of view, it was pretty grim, but not half as grim as it was from the point of view of the troops. We had been held back 24 hours already, owing to the expected gale. The time we set sail from Southampton and cleared the Isle of Wight, the sea had really begun to build up, and we had a very heavy pounding. We were shipping water over the tanks, had our pumps running full belt all the time, and as the seas came up, so the army's stomachs came up also. We felt really sorry for the troops aboard, and our only worry was that we'd have to be putting them ashore when they'd reached the state. But about a few minutes before, we'd been afraid they were going to die. By the time we got on the beach, we'd be glad to die. But fortunately, when we were about 4 miles off the beach, the swell died down, and by the time we got close into the beach, the excitement of the imminent landing and the action of something for them to do apart from just sitting on the tanks or in the tanks. And the majority of them went ashore in a fighting spirit.
Did you know the name of this particular unit you were taking across?
I only knew that it was part of the 3rd Canadian Armoured Division. It consisted of a major in command of 8 Sherman tanks, 1 Miranda, and 2 Jeeps. Their job was to knock out the beach pillboxes and proceed 15 miles inland through calm and fortify themselves in a position for the night. Of course, it was found that calm was heavily defended, and they weren't able to achieve their objective.
Do you remember the name of the major in charge?
I'm afraid not.
Did your craft have a number?
Yes, she was LCT 517 of the 20th Flotilla.
And which particular beach, part of the beach, were you landing on?
On Juno, right at the entrance to Cassell's Harbour.
And as you went in, did you come under enemy fire?
Yes, we were constantly under fire from approximately half a mile off the beach.
From what kind of fire?
Shell fire, gunfire, and as we got nearer to the beach, shrapnel, and of course mortar fire.
Were you hit by this fire as you went in?
Unfortunately, yes. Being the port wing ship of the flotilla, we had no cover ourselves on the port side, and we came under mortar fire. Unfortunately, we lost 2 men killed and 3 others injured. Our greatest problem, though, hadn't been the gunfire so much as the fact that owing to the invasion being postponed for 24 hours and being held up by bad weather for the ships ahead of us, instead of beaching at the low water when all the beached obstacles would have been above water level, we had to beach through beach obstacles, the mines on stakes and the shells hurriedly fastened onto iron stakes and through the iron stakes themselves. The infantry landing craft, small wooden ones, were coming in either side of us, blowing up in all directions on the mines, and we backed away slightly and just let her drift, knocking off as many as we could with our big bow door, until we got two mines on stakes jammed between the door extensions and had to pull away, get off the beach and drop them clear. Also went alongside of one of the destroyers laying off the beach to put aboard our wounded and some of the survivors we'd taken off the beach while we were on there.
I think that as you went into the beach, you arranged for the demolition of a pillbox.
Yes, as we're approaching the beach, our particular point of beach was on the pillbox in the corner of the harbour wall on the sea wall. And when we were close enough to examine it through binoculars, we could see that the gun barrel of a big gun was pointing to the westward along the beach. And the embrasure on the north side was completely open. But as we approached, when we were nearly to the level of the mines, we saw the gun barrel come back in. And knowing full well that they'd had to unscrew the gun barrel to swivel the gun inside the emplacement, and it was obvious that they were now training the gun to come out the embrasure directly opposite us, I got the major in charge of the tanks to get his forward tank close up to a watertight door, got our bow ramp lowered, and our watertight doors opened, and arranged a major for the tank to train onto the pillbox with rounds of solid shot to get the pillbox before the pillbox got us. And fortunately, we hit the beach at full speed. The tank gave a large jump, came to rest, trained his gun on as the gun barrel was coming out, and the first shot was straight in the pillbox, which gave no more trouble after that. Before coming back off the beach, I couldn't resist the temptation to go ashore quickly and see what had happened to the pillbox. It was really an astonishing sight, and it showed how effective a solid shot inside of a concrete pillbox can be.
What sight did you see?
Well, you can cut it out if I shouldn't be saying it. There was literally nothing left but skin, blood, bits of flesh, and all mixed up, just like a load of mincemeat, where the solid shot had simply ricocheted round and round and round in it. Far more effective than a high explosive shell would have been.
So nothing recognisable as human remains?
Not a scrap. Nothing whatsoever.
So you got all your tanks and men safely ashore, apart from the casualties you've described?
Yes, we had no casualties to troops going ashore that we could see. All our tanks got safely up to the top of the beach. The first one, as a matter of course, drove to the pillbox, and the second and third tanks off went to the other two pillboxes, dealt with them, and the other tanks followed them off. After we got rid of the eight tanks, we were able to lift the door, go ahead, so to drop off the two jeeps in the shallow water, by which time we'd attracted the attentions of the assault landing craft to come alongside of us and use us as a causeway to get ashore from.
Was the beach what you'd expected from your briefing?
You mean in the appearance and outline of it, or
yes,
as regards the opposition we were likely to meet?
Well, let's say both.
Both. I had a very good picture of where we got to land, and I was able to recognise it in daylight hours under any circumstances. So there was no problem there, except the point to stress of how efficient and good our reconnaissance had been of the French coast and the points of landing. And when you realise that occupied the whole of the length of the French coast, which had to be done not because there was any possibility of landing at other places, but the probability that someone would be captured while they were reconnaissing the beaches. And if that was in a place where one wasn't going to land, not as much harm could have been done as if somebody had been captured whilst recognising the beach that we were going to land on. As regards the opposition on the beach, well, we were just expecting opposition. Although I must admit that as we approached the beach from 5 miles off, the line of battleships, cruisers and monitors was tremendous. When they started firing over the top of us, we couldn't really imagine that anything could still be alive on the beach when we got there. There was such a tremendous curtain of fire going over the top of us all the time. And then we had the tank landing ships converted to rocket firing ships. They came in, fired their rockets. When each of those rocket ships had more armament equivalent than a flotilla of destroyers, and their plan was to fire the first banks at the water's edge, to fire the other banks as they steamed in. We imagined it had been a solid curtain of the equivalent of 75 millimetre shells going up the beach.